This is Spectator Radio, the Spectator's curated podcast collection.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Emmanuel Centre on an evening where it's not much of an exaggeration to say that the fate of the entire Brexit project is hanging in the balance. Even as we sit here tonight, number 10 is trying to get some last-minute breakthrough to Theresa May's deal to see if she can persuade the House to vote for her withdrawal agreement tomorrow. If she fails, and most people think she will fail, then politicians will have another vote to take on Wednesday. Whether it's time to ask the EU for an extension and delay Brexit, or whether it's time to say that enough is enough and to leave the EU without a deal. Now, our panelists tonight are evenly split on this second question and expertly placed to talk you through the way they see things, how they arrived, and to explain what lies ahead. We have George Eustace, who quit the government 2 weeks ago to speak his mind over Brexit. We have Dominic Grieve, the former Attorney General, who's been one of the most effective Tory rebels. He's arguing for a second referendum. We have Nicky Morgan, former Education Secretary, who's been playing naughty and nice. She's more of a sort of Malthouse-esque chap, which she'll explain when she comes on. And then Suella Braverman, who is a former Brexit minister and, unlike George Eustace, intends to vote against the deal tomorrow. And we have James Forsyth, our political editor, who will be able to do one of those Today programme things where he tells you what the politicians are actually saying at the end. Anyway, so please welcome our panellists this evening. So I'd like to start by asking each of our panellists how they see themselves voting in this rather historic vote tomorrow and why. George Eustace, can I start with you?
Well, I've already made clear that I'm going to vote for the withdrawal agreement tomorrow. I've given the Prime Minister my word that I would, and I'll stand by that. But the main reason for that is that the question of this debate is, who is afraid of no deal? And I'm afraid the answer is that Parliament as a whole is afraid of no deal, and has signalled that very clearly to the European Union consistently. And in doing so, has undermined our negotiating hand throughout this negotiation, left the Prime Minister in a very difficult position. And I fear that unless this deal goes through, the reality is Parliament will vote to bottle it and go for a long extension. And in my view, we shouldn't fear no deal. Firstly, because we have to have the courage to walk through the door without a deal if we want to get a sensible deal at all. But secondly, in recent weeks, we've learned a lot more about what the European Union would do in the event of no deal. And the truth is that in a range of areas, it's obvious that they are looking for an informal understanding, I can put it that way, of a 9-month transition period in the event of no deal, where they will take a light touch approach to border inspection. We already know that inspections won't take place at Calais at all. They're going to move it to a site 6 miles away. They've already asked us to dynamically align our regulations on food in return for listing us as a third country so we can export from day one, which we've agreed. A few weeks ago, there had been concerns over something called travel permits for lorries to be able to travel to Europe. But recently, they've indicated that nothing much will change for 9 months. And this is happening across other policy areas too. So a no deal would be a temporary no deal. It would be no deal yet in many ways, but it would open up a window through which proper negotiations could continue. And I'll just finally say this. Let's not forget, the European Union has said in terms that it will not actually begin proper negotiations on a future partnership until after we've left, until we show we have the courage to take back our independence.
Thank you, John. Dominic Grieve, are you tempted to support the government tomorrow?
My position has been pretty consistent. The deal that has been negotiated, assuming that's the deal which is coming back to us tomorrow, we can't be absolutely sure about that with the events taking place this evening, but the deal that's been negotiated and I agree with George, is a deal for transition and withdrawal and a political declaration that leaves a great deal uncertain. And it bears absolutely no relationship to what was being debated during the 2016 referendum. It bears very little resemblance to what the Prime Minister was talking about when she first started this conversation at Lancaster House. Now, it may well be the only deal available. And if the Prime Minister wishes to put that deal to the British public with the alternative of remaining in the EU, I'd be perfectly happy to support her in doing it. No, it would not be a fix. It bears no resemblance to what we were debating in 2016. We are 2.5 years down the track, nearly three, and the evidence is pretty overwhelming that the vast majority of the public are very unhappy about the deal that has been negotiated. And in my view, there is no alternative to the deal. I'll come back to that at a later stage, because of the problems that about no deal present. So for those reasons, if the Prime Minister wants to put it to the public, I would support her in doing it, and I would campaign myself to remain in the EU.
Nonsense! Thank you. All right, pantomime season isn't quite upon us yet, so let's see if we can get through the end of it. Suella Braverman.
There's nothing I want more than to vote for the government's deal tomorrow. But I am waiting to see what may emerge this evening. And if nothing changes compared to the deal that was presented to Parliament in January, I will vote against the deal. I don't believe that this deal, as presented in its current form, represents Brexit. And it runs the very high risk that the UK gets locked indefinitely into a customs union, breaking one of the key pledges and promises of what was what the referendum result meant and what a majority of British people understood to mean in leaving the EU. But Fraser... But ultimately, what this comes down to for me is trust. And can the British people trust their parliament, their politicians, the people they put in that place down the road to represent their views? Whether it's in the form of an historic referendum where we saw record levels of people engaged and turning out to vote and queues of people outside the polling station and a very lively and a heated debate at times, or whether it's the subsequent general election where 80% of voters supported parties that were backing Brexit. And ultimately, this will come down to whether Parliament and government, these elected people, can honour that trust and can deliver for the British people in delivering Brexit on the 29th of March. And the Prime Minister has worked hard. I have supported her in the department to settle and reach an agreement. But if that fails, we have to be ready to leave on a WTO no deal Brexit. And to wrap up, to give he a chance. I'm not scared of no deal. I believe that the second rerun of Project Fear is not working for me. The benefits to leaving the EU without a negotiated settlement are several that I hope to talk about later this evening. There will be challenges. My preferred outcome is a deal, but there will be challenges. And to talk of no deal is somewhat of a misnomer. Because when we talk of no deal, what we actually mean is very many smaller bilateral agreements between the UK and the EU, which many of which have reached a very advanced stage of planning in financial services, in agriculture, in customs, in holidays, in citizens' rights. I could go on. The benefits to WTO, the majority of the world's countries trade on WTO. There's nothing for our country, our great nation, a fifth economy of the world, a thriving legal system, a thriving economy, record employment. There's nothing for us as a nation, as a people, to fear from a WTO Brexit.
And finally, Nicky Morgan.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I'm getting a sense from the applause of where this audience might be coming from this evening. And to live up to Fraser's introduction, I think in the pantomime analogy, I think perhaps at some points this evening I'll be the good fairy and some points this evening I'll be the wicked witch of the West, as far as you are all concerned. I will vote for the deal tomorrow because I think it takes us one large step towards the UK leaving the European Union. And you might think that's something that you wouldn't have expected me to say, because obviously I am was a vocal campaigner for the Remain campaign 3 years ago. But I have been very, very clear since the morning of the 24th of June that I accepted, with heavy heart, that I accepted the UK would be leaving the EU. Now I hear... Oh, please applaud. Yes, absolutely. That's the good fairy bit. Now, I hear what people say about this is not what people voted for when they voted for Brexit, or alternative people say this is not what was promised and doesn't measure up and everything else. But politics is the art of the possible. And I think one of the things that we have learnt over the last couple of years is that compromise should not be a dirty word. And that's why I, when I was approached, was involved in the Malthouse Compromise, because if we don't begin to bring both sides of this together, we are never going to get anywhere with both Brexit or anything else as a country. And I would just say to my colleagues as they're voting tomorrow that I think we should be very aware of the fact that actions and votes have consequences. And as Conservatives, and I have absolutely no intention of leaving the Conservative Party, where I've been a member for 30 years, one of our watchwords is to provide strength, strong government, a strong economy, safety and security for the people of this country. And not putting an agreement in place for all perfectly principled objections actually would not help either the government to sustain itself nor for us to move on to the important negotiations of the future relationship. And this is what we're voting on tomorrow. We're not voting on whether Brexit should or shouldn't happen. That debate has happened. We shouldn't rerun it. We're not voting on what the future relationship between the UK and the EU is going to be, although I hear the arguments of those who say that buried within the withdrawal agreement is a clever way for the EU to try to keep us in the customs union. We are voting to bring to an end phase one of the withdrawal. And I think that actually bringing to an end that phase one, which at the moment is deeply debilitating this debate to the country and to our constituents, is something that we should be seeking to do to move on to the much more important phase two, those future trade relationship, that future relationship about security, financial services, and everything else. And so that is why I shall vote for the Prime Minister's agreement tomorrow.
So, James Forsyth, we heard some very lots of diverging views here. Is there a theme you can suppose here?
Well, I think this panel sums up Theresa May's problem. We've got four Conservative MPs, but only two of them are voting for her deal. And to compound Theresa May's problem, Dominic and Suella are voting against it for totally opposing reasons. If Theresa May was going to get her deal through the House of Commons, she needed MPs who feared no deal, to think that the only way to prevent no deal was to vote for her deal. But Dominic is no fan of no deal, yet he feels confident that he can vote against her deal on Tuesday night and not end up with no deal, because he knows that on Wednesday he will get a chance to express his opposition to no deal, and then on Thursday he will get a chance to vote for an extension. So Dominic doesn't worry about the consequences of voting against Theresa May's deal. Meanwhile, Suella thinks that this withdrawal agreement does not represent a decisive enough Brexit. But Suella isn't worried that voting against it is going to lead to no Brexit, because she thinks that the legal default is that we leave with or without a deal on the 29th of March. And this is Theresa May's problem, which is no one was ever going to love her deal, but people might have embraced it as the least worst option. But that is not happening in sufficient numbers for Theresa May to get her deal across the line. I always think there's an irony, which is every day I walk into the House of Commons and I pass two groups of protesters, both shouting at each other, sometimes obscenely, sometimes not. The irony is, if they were MPs, every single one of them would be walking through the same division lobby on Tuesday night. And that is fundamentally Theresa May's problem. She has managed to unite both sides of the debate against her deal. And this is the issue. Now, on the one hand, you can say that this is a spectacular political failure, which it is in a way. But there is another thing. Both sides can't be right. History is going to turn around and say that one of Dominic or Suella made an epic mistake on Tuesday night. Now, I do not know which one it is. I suspect it might be the Brexiteers making the mistake, but we shall wait and see. But I think this is the big problem for Theresa May, is that the reason she doesn't have much hope of winning her vote tomorrow night, unless something miraculous happens in Strasbourg this evening, that, you know, Jean-Claude Juncker has a very good evening and decides that he's in a generous mood, is that these two blocks of opinion in the House of Commons are both going to unite against her deal, and the middle is not strong enough to deliver it for her.
So, well, I'd like to put James's point to you then. His point is that, sure, we understand the intellectual consistency of your position, but the outcome might be the opposite of what you want. That by voting against the deal, you're realistically not going to get no deal. I'd be interested to think if you think the no deal stands a chance of passing Parliament. And the realistic alternative to that might be a delay and perhaps no Brexit. So you could be shooting yourself in the foot.
All I can control is my vote as a backbencher in Parliament. That's my job. And my job is therefore to look at the facts as they are before me and to try and speak as honestly as I can to the people who put me in Parliament. That's how I see my role. I look at this deal, as I said earlier, it is not Brexit for me and for many, many people in Parliament. I therefore cannot honestly vote for something which was promised to the British people at the referendum and in the general election. The manifesto made it clear that no deal was better than a bad deal. All Conservative MPs got elected on that platform. And I find it astonishing how we're even having this debate, actually, that no deal wouldn't be the default. I cannot predict what will happen if this deal gets defeated again tomorrow. It may well be that Mrs. May goes back to Brussels and tries again, and there might be another meaningful vote, and you might have another panel like this on the eve of another historic debate. Or it may well be that we proceed to this series of votes. I don't want to predict the outcome of those votes. I'm not sure that an extension to Article 50 will command a majority in Parliament. But at the end of the day, even if Parliament may choose those unacceptable terms, as I see that, a rejection of no deal or an extension of Article 50, ultimately, it will be for the government to allow these an extension to take place. It will be for the government to pass requisite legislation, and it will be for the government to sanction that course of action. That's out of my control. And I don't feel, and I will always be able to look my constituents in the eye and say, I did what I thought was right in rejecting a package which didn't honour the referendum and didn't deliver Brexit.
So, George Eustace, nobody's in any doubt about your own commitment to Brexit. You used to be a member of UKIP before it was fashionable. Well, was it ever fashionable? I don't know. But years ago, anyway, before this was. So you've heard Suella there. The manifesto said no deal is better than a bad deal. You don't seem to think this is a good deal, yet you're going to vote for it anyway.
Well, for precisely the reason I said, I think there is a danger that we could unleash, and this is the reason I resigned. What's effectively happened is that Parliament has now taken the government hostage. The government is not in control of events. Parliament is deciding exactly what happens next. And I suspect that the most likely sequence of events in the next few weeks is that the withdrawal agreement will be voted down. Parliament will then vote to take no deal off the table, whatever that might mean. Parliament will then vote to command the Prime Minister to go cap in hand to the European Union to beg for an extension. There's no guarantee the EU will give us that extension, and no guarantee at all about what terms they might attach to it. What if they say the price is you have to give us the £39 billion up front? What if the price is actually it has to be 2 years, it can't be a short extension, that's all we will consider? What if, worst case scenario, they say we won't give you an extension, but the European Court of Justice has very generously given you the ability to revoke it unilaterally? What happens then? Parliament, in its wisdom, will have taken control of this event, all 650 of them, thinking they can do the negotiation better than the government could. And with probably 2 or 3 days to go, Parliament will be left confronted with a diabolical decision. And I don't know what they would do then. It's possible that at that 11th hour, they would step back from the brink and think, you know what, we are a serious country after all, so we're going to get out without an agreement. Or maybe they wouldn't. And I think that would be a national humiliation.
Dominic Grieve, you also stood in a Conservative manifesto saying the no deal was better than a bad deal. At the time, did you think, well, I'm going to have to go along with this, I simply don't believe it? And also, Nicky Morgan said that she will be a Conservative for the foreseeable future. Could you say the same?
Well, I'm a Conservative to my fingertips. I've been a member of the Conservative Party for 43, 44 years.
You were talking about leaving it last month, weren't you?
No.
You were on Newsnight where you said that if the Parliament voted for no deal, then you might leave the party.
No, that's not... Well, that's... I will be around in the Conservative Party much longer than you.
I'm not a member, so you've already won that one.
You may not well be... Let's take it in stages. I mean, firstly, I spent the first 12 months after the referendum trying to see the silver lining in the cloud. And that's why I voted to trigger Article 50, because I wanted to honour the commitment. And I did. But I have to say that the longer this debate has gone on, the clearer it's become to me that we are in the middle of an exercise in self-mutilation. That is what Brexit will deliver for this country. And it's a very serious matter. As for the manifesto, it was published after I was selected, after my nomination papers went in, and I made the point that I would do my best to support the Prime Minister in trying to get a deal which maintained a close relationship with our European Union partners. And I made that quite clear in the course of the campaign. And it's worth bearing in mind that at that time, she was talking of a rather different relationship, because the only basis at that stage was the Lancaster House speech. As this has gone on, it's become clearer and clearer to me that we are going to end up with a third-rate outcome for our country. And the alternative, which is no deal, although I think we need to be a bit clear what we're talking about here, whether it's real no deal, that's crashing out on the 29th of March, or some sort of managed no deal, but real no deal is catastrophic. And it is catastrophic in my judgment, and therefore under no circumstances could I possibly support it. Now, that said, I'm also, contrary to what has just been suggested earlier, that I don't worry about things. I worry about things a great deal for the future of our country. It keeps me awake at night, and I'm constantly thinking of areas where I try to listen to what other people are saying to me. But one of the difficulties is that leaving, admittedly no deals, total no deal is probably different, but leaving is leaving into an unresolved debate about the future relationship between our country and the EU. If I had confidence that there was some unanimity of view about what that should be, it might make me, despite the Prime Minister's difficult position, more inclined to support her. But the reality is very clear that the moment we leave the EU, what is going to be followed is a very difficult debate about the future direction of travel of this country, in which some people in my party will be trying to unpick the very deal which he's put together. And that's why I am become, I think, more intransigent about this outcome. Because it seems to me that this is a debate that has to be had now. Our country will not survive the process of debate that is being contemplated. The union of the United Kingdom is undoubtedly in danger from what is happening. And I'm a unionist as well as being a conservative. And those two things together make me absolutely determined to stick to the current course I've adopted.
Nicky Morgan, can I ask how you would feel if the government were to support no deal? I mean, Dominic, although he kind of his memory is a little bit hazy, but he was saying a couple of weeks ago that he would, and he's put, I wouldn't be able to maintain my support for the government, I would have to leave the party. How would
can I just specify? Yes, if the Prime Minister were to come along on the 28th of March and say she has embraced no deal, and she's decided to leave on the following day with a no-deal Brexit, yes, I would resign the whip on the spot.
Okay. Good to see you guys cheering, being a bit more positive now towards our guests. So. Nicky Morgan, how would you... I mean, Dominic's been very honest and forthright about what he regards as the calamity of no deal and what it would bring. Would you say the same?
I am very concerned about leaving the EU in 18 days' time without a withdrawal agreement in place.
How bad would it be? Are we talking discomfort or calamity?
Well, the honest truth is that, for me personally, I think it would be... I think the whole point is it's completely unknown. So the evidence we've had, the Treasury Select Committee, which I chair, from various bodies, including the Bank of England and others, is that nobody knows what such a trade supply shock could do, because nobody else has done it. And this is the problem. On the one hand, we hear people saying it could be short-term disruption, and that in a matter of weeks or perhaps months, we would be through the worst of it. On the other, it could go on for much longer. We know that negotiating future trade deals is going to take longer. I think it's going to be more politically contentious than anybody is yet prepared for. I'm cautious about using words like calamity because I think that we have, in this whole debate, we have often tended to go for the most overblown words on either side. And actually, I don't think that serves the public very well, who really want an honest appraisal from people on this platform, from their leaders of the country, as to what is really going on, because people are trying to make decisions about investing in their business, taking a new employee on, moving house, decision about whether to stay in this country, whether to accept a new job. They just want to know what is going to happen. And that's my problem with a no deal on the 29th of March, is I can't give my constituents any certainty or confidence about what's going to happen. But Dominic is right, and I think George has said this as well, that actually there is a sort of sneering that goes on about this phrase, manage no deal. But actually, it would be possible to enter into a series of different agreements that might actually mean that not having a withdrawal agreement doesn't necessarily lead to the risks of calamity or disruption in the way that people might expect. And so my rather loyally boring political answer is ahead of Wednesday is I want to know if we do get to that, and I hope we don't because the agreement is approved, what is the motion? What does it say? I have been part of the Malthouse Compromise, which envisages a Plan B, which is where the UK would offer to pay for a standstill period. And my understanding is that George, having been a minister, and others say that actually there are parts of the EU who are ready to give us a standstill of some kind. And I think that would be worth exploring. One of the great frustrations is I don't sometimes think things have been explored in negotiations with the EU in the way that they should have been, which might have led to some more interesting debate. So the long-winded answer is saying I'm not keen on a no deal, literally nothing in place on the 29th of March, but I think all other options should be considered. I haven't made up my mind how I would vote on Wednesday. I will be looking to the government for guidance about exactly what it was they were talking about in that motion.
Okay. Mrs. Swellen.
Nicky makes some really good points, and where I disagree with Nicky is we have made advanced plans in terms of these agreements with the EU on a whole range of areas for the eventuality that we leave with a no deal. On car certification, that was approved just by the EU Parliament last week. On citizens' rights, the Spanish made an announcement last week on UK citizens over there. On a whole range of matters, legislatively, the UK is very well prepared. So I do believe we are in a very good place when it comes to domestic and the EU level of planning for that no deal scenario. And where I commend Nikki is her work on the Malthouse Compromise. And as she set out, part of that Malthouse Compromise is Plan B, and I support that compromise. That is based on a rule of the WTO, Article 24, which, as Nikki says, ensures zero for zero tariffs for a period of time by which the UK would actually pay, and does give us that time that people who are concerned about no deal for the UK and businesses to prepare in a fuller way. But I think it would be great if the government would embrace the work that Nikki and colleagues have done with Jacobs, Rees-Mogg, Steve Baker and Damian Green, coming together, coalescing around a middle way forward that can unite various both wings of the party. But unfortunately, after about a month or so of working on it, and they've put in so much work on this, there doesn't seem to be that ray of sunshine from the government. And all I'm praying for is for the government to make that its policy, to push it very strongly with the EU, and I think we would find a way forward, actually.
James, Suella Braverman's looking for a ray of sunshine. What's your weather forecast?
I think the problem is this, is we didn't have a weather forecast 2 and a bit years ago before Article 50 was triggered. I think it is remarkable.
It's real sunshine. A lot of Brexit years told us it would be the easiest thing in the world to get to deal with the EU.
It is remarkable how many things are still being discussed. It is remarkable that we are still talking about what technology could or could not work on the Irish border at this point in the process. I think if you go back, in a way, to the original sin of this process, I think it is this, is because Theresa May had campaigned for Remain, when she became Prime Minister, she felt under huge and undoubted political pressure to do everything to show that she was going to do Brexit. I mean, that led to her triggering Article 50 far, far earlier than she should have done. I think you can argue it was clear beforehand, but certainly clear with the benefit of hindsight. It would have been much better for the United Kingdom to work on, you know, building up the infrastructure that it would need to trade more easily, not only with other countries in the rest of the world, building up a credible negotiating leverage that showed that you were serious about no deal. So building up some channel ports that faced Belgium and Holland so that Dover-Calais wasn't such an obvious choke point. And I think sitting down with the Irish government to see what the UK and Irish governments bilaterally could come to, so they were going to the European Commission saying, look, we've come to some kind of agreement on the border. Can you guys accept that? And I think this is one of the problems, is that we rushed into triggering Article 50. And then it was over a year later at Chequers, but the government actually came up with its position on the kind of future relationship it wanted with the EU. It is remarkable that, given it's a two-year time-limited process, which everyone knew during the referendum campaign was one of the vulnerabilities of leaving, that the government triggered it and then spent a year negotiating with itself about what it wanted. Right.
Well, the negotiation is far from over. And before we put it open to the floor, Dominic Grieve, I'd like to ask you, you are a committed Remainer. I think your maiden speech was speaking up in your admiration for the ECHR.
Well, that's not quite the same thing, actually.
Well,
the ECHR has nothing to do with the EU. So these are two totally distinct things. So it's quite important not to mix the two up.
Is there anything that would have reconciled you to the referendum results?
If I had thought that, you know, I campaigned to remain in the referendum, I thought that the decision we've taken is a mistaken one. But I did, as I explained earlier, I spent the first 12 months looking to see can we actually carve out a relationship which is going to be significantly better than the deal we have within the EU? Will it meet our national aspirations? Will it maintain our economic well-being, our national security, which is something I pay quite a lot of attention to as chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, and our quality of life? And my conclusion, as I watched the negotiations unfold and the restrictions come in on the red lines, although I can understand why they were introduced by the Prime Minister, was that it would fail on every single count. And in those circumstances, my view is that we are about to make a great and historic mistake. It's my personal judgment. I realize others will disagree with it. But my concern is that where we're, as I said earlier, is that where we have actually ended up bears no relationship to what we were talking about in the referendum, which unfortunately it was inevitable, was an abstract series of questions. And I think it is both right and democratic in those circumstances to ask people what they want. If they indeed wish to leave on the Prime Minister's terms, or the adjusted terms that the Prime Minister can negotiate, or indeed any other terms which are capable of implementation and are lawful, I would be just have to accept it, because it would be an informed choice made after 2.5 years of intense public debate. But I also think that there's quite a lot of compelling evidence that the entire Brexit project, the wheels are coming off. And in those circumstances, I don't see it as very democratic to pull people out of the European Union into a future which fewer and fewer people appear to want. And that's why they should also be offered the option of remaining.
Okay. Let's open it to questions. Actually, a quick show of hands for who would vote for no deal? Who would vote against no deal? What do you reckon, Dominic?
Well,
is that...
The majority here appear to be no dealers.
That looks about 70-30?
Yes. Not altogether to my surprise, so...
Who voted Remain?
Some Remainers as well, yeah.
Decent number. Who would like a second referendum? Not an indecent number, so...
Thank you for coming.
And who wants to ask the first question? Sir.
Hello. So I spent a good part of my life learning how a citizen of this country holds government to account. It took a while, but I think I've got my head around it. My question to Dominic Grieve. If you sort of seize control from the cabinet, how am I supposed to hold you and your group to account? What's the procedures? How can I do anything if I don't like where you're going?
So when you say seize control, sir, what do you mean?
I'm talking about the amendment that takes control of the timetable.
Right.
And also what was mentioned, like the possibility that if the EU comes back saying we've got these demands, it will be Parliament and not the Cabinet who addresses those demands.
Okay. So, Dominic, there will be lots of talk about Parliament taking control. In that case, how does he... shows opposition to Parliament.
I think there are two... Can we just start with the first basic question? I mean, there is a constitutional issue here. The first thing is that Parliament, the House of Commons, has constitutionally entire control of its proceedings. It's a very well-established convention. The fact that over time, particularly in the early 20th century, governments have taken control of bits of that process with Parliament's acquiescence does not mean that Parliament is acting in any way unconstitutionally in changing its processes if it wishes. So issues like amendable motions, for example, are completely in keeping with our current unwritten constitution. And to suggest otherwise is in fact to say that Parliament is no more the House of Commons than a rubber stamp. The issue about legislating, MPs bring in private members' bills and they can pass them through the House. We don't have the power to pass money resolutions, which is why, for example, Parliament couldn't, even if it wanted to, enact a bill to hold a second referendum against the government's wishes, something which I think some people haven't understood, but is the truth. You could do it, but it really would be revolutionary. It would be going back to the middle of the 17th century. It hasn't happened since 1660. So that's one aspect. But on the other hand, the bill introduced by, or suggested by Oliver Letwin and Yvette Cooper is entirely in order for the House of Commons to pass. And where you have a government which doesn't have a majority in the House of Commons, it has either got to go to the country and dissolve Parliament, or it has to accept that Parliament may at times vote in a way that it itself might not wish, and it has to adjust to that. So those are the basic building blocks. As for holding parliamentarians to account, well, that happens regularly at general elections. That is what general elections are all about. And I'm sure that when we come to another general election, I don't know whether it will be sooner or later or this parliament will go its five-year term, people will have every opportunity to do just that.
But Dominic, don't you think that that, in what you're proposing and advocating there, is a breach of trust? People will have voted in good faith for the Conservative Party to deliver Brexit, and what has been proposed, Chair, is a minority group of self-appointed MPs who will have no mandate whatsoever, who will encompass minority party MPs, and therefore trump what people in good faith voted for and believed in passing their vote.
Hold on, Sweller. You cannot have a minority of MPs passing majority decisions in the House of Commons. It is absolutely self-contradictory. If Parliament decides to enact legislation ordering the Prime Minister as a matter of law to get an extension to Article 50, that will be because a majority of members of the House of Commons voting have decided to do just that. So Parliament is not in any way operating in some unusual fashion.
It's also turning on its head the constitutional arrangement that we have in our government, whereby governments propose legislation and parliaments endorse it or approve it or scrutinise it, not the other way around. And what you're proposing turns that completely upside down.
I just disagree fundamentally with the constitutional analysis on that. It is Parliament's right to pass laws, and the government does not control the order paper in all circumstances. It's true that these are unusual circumstances that we're in, and as I say, the remedy, if you needed one, would be a general election if the government didn't like what Parliament was doing, and in those circumstances. So I'm afraid I don't accept the basic premise. I mean, I am respectful of the Constitution. If I wanted to rip the Constitution apart, then trying to pass money resolutions without the government's consent, that would indeed be revolutionary. But we are living in revolutionary times. The first revolution we've had was the revolution of Brexit, and we are living with the consequences of it.
But, Mr. Grieve, what you're missing is that the people have decided. You may have a technical ability to change. Are you suggesting seriously that Parliament could just decide, because it's got a sufficient majority, to pass legislation that hadn't been put on any mandate? Are you saying that? Because that's what you're trying to do now. You don't have a mandate for the legislation you're trying to push through.
At the moment, no such legislation is being pushed through at all. No, it isn't. It had no reading. It hasn't been presented. Bills have been published. And discussions are taking place with government about the way the government wishes to approach this. As for the question as to what Parliament's powers are, the House of Commons has extensive powers which it is entitled to exercise if it thinks it's necessary. And it is entitled to do that if it thinks that the situation of the country warrants it. Yes, it is. That's the whole principle of parliamentary sovereignty.
Let's hear from Nicky Morgan on this question.
Well, I think that's an interesting point to think about, isn't it? And as I was listening to Dominic speaking, just because Parliament can do something, or members of Parliament can, should they do it?
Well, that's a different issue.
And actually, I'm not sure it is a different issue, because it's separate, obviously, from the issue about passing legislation or having resolutions. But I think in all of this, I think there was a brilliant speech given by Lee Rowley, one of our new members of Parliament, just at the end of February in that debate. And he said to members of Parliament, he said, it's not about you. It's not about the four of us. You're absolutely right, sir. The vote was given to the people. And it's not good enough to say, oh, it's 37% is the 17 million or anything else. The point was, we had a vote in this country and people voted. They didn't vote the way that I campaigned, but that's what democracy is. And I think it's absolutely right
I think it is right that members of Parliament should use our judgment to look and to scrutinise at the government's proposals for carrying out implementing that decision. I have great sympathy for what James said, which is actually what we're seeing now play out is the consequences of decisions made by the government, the Prime Minister, 2 years ago in terms of red lines and everything else. But the point is, I think there comes a point where we've got to stand back and think it's not just about our own personal consciences or personal judgments. It's about what is right for the country and what the consequences of acting in a certain way are, leading to greater instability and more divisions in this country, rather than trying to heal the enormous divisions represented in this room and elsewhere.
I don't disagree with Nicky's analysis on that, but the simple point is that in the referendum, I don't remember the discussion taking place, well, the point was made earlier, about the promises that were made about leaving with a satisfactory deal. The possibility of crashing out on the 29th of March with absolutely no arrangements in place at all, I don't remember being debated. And I, as a member of Parliament... No, it wasn't. It was not even in the manifesto, because when the Prime Minister used that term, I actually took it at that stage, bad deal, no deal, to be an issue around the withdrawal agreement. So all I can say is that I, as an MP, have a responsibility to my constituents and a responsibility I see to my country not to allow something to happen to it which I think would be overwhelmingly damaging. And that happening is crashing out with no deal. And therefore, I take it as my duty that I've got to do everything I can to stop that. Now, I hope very much, I don't think the Prime Minister probably wishes to do that. So it may well turn out to be quite unnecessary to start producing bills to actually coerce the Prime Minister or order her to do something. But I'm prepared to contemplate that, along with a group of people who don't like Oliver Letwin, who doesn't really come across to me as being a revolutionary in spirit, precisely because I think the issue is so important.
Okay. Anybody on Dominic's side who wants to ask a difficult question of George Eustace? Look at all those hands go down. Come on, there must be somebody here. It's okay, you can always say, do you agree at the end, and then make out like it's a question.
No, I would just say how disgusted I am that we can't listen to Dominic Grieve in quiet, the quiet that we give to other people. I think it's appalling.
I think the majority are clearly with you there, ma'am. Right, let's have another question, please. Kinga, choose someone you like to look off.
Yes, there's been a lot of comment about the fact that being afraid of no deal has only come about because we didn't have enough backbone earlier. But I'd like to ask the panel what they feel about this. That, in fact, the reason we're in this situation is not from lack of backbone, but from lack of imagination. There's been no debate as to how we would carry forward the future of Britain after we leave. And that paucity of imagination comes from a lack of understanding about the human dynamic, what it is that really achieves change, what it is that really drives economic growth. It's not the corporatism of the European Union, of the giant banks, or of the lobbyists. It's the 99% of the businesses in Britain that are small and medium-sized that can certainly see through no deal or any deal and make the change in the future as they have all through the growth of Britain. So. But perhaps we could just hear from some of the panel about what ideas they have to grow Britain, to have constitutional change and imagination going into the future. Thank you.
Right. George Eustace, I'd like to throw that you minded to vote for no deal. That would, if you get your way, that would require pretty huge amounts of imagination, of positive thinking, of an agenda. What would you do? What would you propose? How do you think Britain would be able to navigate its way? Because imagine the scene. The Prime Minister's deal has been rejected. She might even fall. The Parliament votes for an eventuality that the civil service is prepared for, but we're not quite sure how far they're prepared for. But what we would need, I put to you, is something we haven't really had from the Tories, and that is leadership. So...
Well,
let's hear what you think should be done.
The gentleman asked raised a very important point, which is throughout this process, my sense is that both from the Whitehall machinery, but also in Parliament and in government, there's been too much of a sense that Brexit is a decision that we must, quote, respect, but it is also a risk that should be mitigated. And I'm someone who campaigned to leave because I actually think, you know what, the European Union is not the end of our history. It's simply a passing episode within it. And I don't think... I personally don't think the EU model of centralised, you know, bureaucratic diktat is actually right for the 21st century. It's a 1970s model. And the answer, I think, to the question is we, as a country, should focus on science and innovation and technology and the resources that we have as a country, both intellectual resources but our natural resources as well, and have the confidence to go out in the world and do that and recognise that actually it's perfectly capable. You're perfectly capable of trading without having a complete alignment of all of your regulations. But also that in modern economies, you know, the idea that it's all about trade, I think, can get exaggerated. When you look at the modelling, the truth is that the opportunities from an American trade deal are more marginal than some people pretend. But equally, leaving the EU without a trade deal matters less than others pretend. The truth is that in modern economies, the way that growth is driven is through your intellectual resources, your focus on innovation and science and other such matters. And we need to focus on those types of things if we want to be successful in the future.
Suella Braverman, you were saying earlier you were surprised we're even having this debate about no deal, given that it ought to have been the natural consequence of the EU coming up with something Parliament couldn't back. But hasn't it been your party which has catastrophically let the ball drop here? Nobody's really made the argument for the alternative, and it's this failure of leadership, this failure of nerve, which has let Parliament think, well, George Eustace might be right when he says that we could probably get through this, but so few people are making the argument that there just simply isn't the will to go through with what's an almighty gamble with, it seems, hardly any preparation for that gamble.
Well, the gentleman taps into the sentiment that I think millions of people around the country felt when they voted to leave the European, that for freedom, that for opportunity, that for our country to be the master of its own destiny. And one of the biggest ways in which we can be master of our destiny as a nation, with our genius and our talent and our heritage and all we've brought to the world, is through trade. And why I can't vote for this deal is because it locks us indefinitely into a customs union. But there are huge opportunities to a WTO Brexit because of trade. We come out of the customs union. Our trade deficit with the EU allows us, shows that markets in the EU are slower and don't purchase as many goods from British manufacturers and British producers as the rest of the world. Our trade with countries with whom we trade on a WTO no-deal Brexit, supposedly catastrophic and devastating and decimating, is actually growing three times faster than our trade with the EU.
Sorry, I'm trying to remote control my colleague here because I see Sir Christopher Mayer in the audience. I'd love to take a question from him. Sir Christopher, can you make yourself known? We get nothing but the best in our spectator audiences, I should say.
Don't worry. Thanks. I wanted to raise something this evening with the panel. I'm very interested in their reaction, which has not yet been mentioned, even by James. And it is this, that by the end of this year, we will have a new European Parliament after the elections in May. We'll have a new European Commission and a new President of the Commission. Juncker will depart the scene. And I think I'm right in saying we'll have a new president of the council, which means that Donald Tusk will depart the scene. So the entire leadership of the European Union and the European Commission and the European Parliament will move on and be replaced by a new team. Is that an argument, in your view, for having a new team over here in the United Kingdom to lead our side of the negotiations, or is it an argument for hanging on to those who are hardened by the battles with the European Commission? Thank you.
Great. James Forsyth, do you think Tusk's sort of Sancerre days are coming to a close with the knot and Juncker?
I think the conduct of the negotiation over the last 2 and a bit years is the reason for having a new team negotiating on the UK's behalf. I also think that, Christian, you touched on something very important here, which is this whole issue of the European elections coming up in May, the start of a new European Parliament term in July, which is when we talk about an extension, this is the grit in the oyster, which is there is no way the EU is going to allow us to extend, so we're still in the EU after the new term of the European Parliament starts in July, if we haven't elected MEPs. Yet, if we were to hold European Parliament elections, I think it would be a complete shellacking for both main parties for very different reasons. I mean, the Tories would lose a lot of votes to a more pro-Leave party, and Labour would lose a lot of votes to a more explicitly pro-Remain party. So I think this is one of the tensions when we talk about this extension, which is either it is going to be so short that I can't quite see what more could be done in it, or if it is longer, if it is 21 months, then I think it is going to borrow Dominic's analogy, it's going to move the revolution along to the next phase, because you'll get a European Parliament election results, which I think will be very bad for both of the main parties.
Okay. Anybody want to contribute to that cheery prognosis from James?
All I would say on the prognosis, it's not... I mean, extending Article 50 beyond the date of the European parliamentary elections undoubtedly has some process difficulties. They're not necessarily insurmountable, but they are undoubtedly present. And whether the EU would be willing to help us surmount them is an unanswered question on which there are mixed messages when you talk to EU interlocutors. As for whether it would be desirable to hold European parliamentary elections if we're still in, there is an argument that it might be. It might be rather cathartic for the two main parties. I mean, I disagree very slightly with James's analysis about where the votes would go. I think the evidence in my own constituency, when I look at the voters who vote Conservative, is that there's a very serious risk that quite a few of those would be going off and voting for a non-Conservative party, and it wouldn't be for the party which has a more extreme view on Brexit. It would be for the party that supports Remaining. I think the evidence of that is overwhelming.
The Lib Dems?
No, it wouldn't be the Lib Dems. I suspect it would be the Tiggers if they put up a list. Ooh. Yep.
This is quite interesting because the Tiggers has just come up here. And do you actually think, Dominic, agree that the Tiggers will be a factor? And you mentioned your constituency. I mean, how is your position going down with your constituency party?
Well, the position with my, I mean, firstly with talking about the Tiggers, any new party has great difficulty establishing itself. But a list system in an election is the classic place for them to do so. Yeah. As for my own association, I have had, because it has required, I have no doubt, forbearance, but I have had supportive officers. But I have an association of 1,100 members, and it doesn't surprise me at all that in view of the divisions which exist on this issue, there are divisions within my association. I have some people in my association who are very supportive of me, and I have others who, for perfectly understandable reasons, are not. How that will resolve itself is a matter which we're going to have to wait and see. And in a sense, there's nothing I can do about it, because unless I decide not to be true to my own principles, which is something I'm not prepared to do, I have to face the consequences of my actions. But that's the position as it stands at the moment.
Can I just say?
It's real, yeah.
On the UK fielding candidates at the European elections in the event of an extension, I think it would be devastating for our democracy, because frankly, what would be the point of voting for either of the main parties? We will have completely let you down in delivering on a basic promise. And I fear that the European elections, just as we've seen all of throughout mainland Europe, far-right parties on the rise in Germany, in France, in Italy, in Greece. I think Brexit has contained that and allowed people to have trust in their democracy that they were going to deliver on concerns, valid concerns about migration. And this failure to deliver Brexit will only unleash these very dangerous forces which are at the moment latent and kept under attack.
Just a couple of very brief points on this, and that is, first of all, internally in parts of Whitehall, they've already turned their thoughts to what might happen and how we could get around the issue of European elections. And one idea that's been doing the rounds is that you could go back to the pre-1979 arrangement where we send delegates from our Westminster Parliament rather than have to have elections. I think that's a very bad idea, but I think it's concerning that it's even being considered. Now, the second thing is, in terms of what could be done within 3 months, a very pertinent point by James. The truth is, the only plausible thing that could be done in that time is to transfer to the EFTA pillar and to assert our existing rights under the EEA treaty. Now, that is an option. As a fallback plan, if all else fails, that is an option that gets us through in the short term and delivers Brexit, not quite on time, but a few months late.
Nikki Morgan, can I ask you about Suella's point there? Yeah. She was pointing out how Britain's one of the few countries in the whole of Europe not to have a serious populist party at large right now, mainly because we've internalized all of our little, what Dominic Grieve calls a revolution. It's happening within the main parties. Do you think that if Brexit doesn't happen this week, if there's a vote for a delay or whatever, then that will lead to support for the fringe parties and we might end up with a situation more similar to that in the continent?
Sadly, I do. I don't think that's necessarily a reason not to vote, according to how people think is the right way this week. But I think it has to be a factor in how people make their... It should be a factor in what people do. I don't see why we would want, on this panel or in Westminster, to give any encouragement to more extremist parties in our democracy.
If you block Brexit, though, you will, surely.
Say it again?
If you block Brexit.
Well, I'm not intending to block Brexit. I'm intending to vote for the withdrawal agreement, which, in my opinion, actually would enable the UK to leave
and
the European Union on the 29th of March. Well, if it falls, I mean, Suella may be right. Maybe we'll get a third meaningful vote. Whether we're going to have... I mean, I'm not in favour of having a three-month extension of Article 50. I think it's worse than useless as far as greater business certainty for businesses. I think it's more kicking the can down the road. I think we'll be back. It might be sunnier outside, but we'll still be debating exactly the same issues in 3 months' time. We've got to get on with this. You know, enough after 2 years. When I heard Suella just saying there about the far right, I mean, she may well be right. It might be latent. I have to say, it's not hidden. You only had to watch the programme on the abuse suffered by me and other MPs, and it's happened. It's not just for those on the programme. It was many others in the course of the last couple of years to see that angry people are all over our social media making threats. I mean, I know that Dominic's had a number of significant threats. I've had Nick Bowles, as have other people such as Andrea Leadsom, which have led to prosecutions. This is not what we want for our political system. This is not acceptable. But can I just say... Fraser, can I say one other thing as well? So just to answer the gentleman right at the back there, and actually Sir Christopher as well, you're absolutely right. What has been missing has been the vision thing. Now, we can be sceptical sometimes about that in this country, but it matters. If you're going to take a position where 48% of the country weren't very happy, the way to bring them across is to show them what the future looked like and exactly how you are going to offer people a brighter future. You're going to get wages growing again, you're going to improve productivity, you're going to get businesses expanding, more jobs created. The best thing we have to invest in this country is our people. And we have lamentably failed. I haven't been in government, as you might have noticed, the last 3 years nearly, but we have lamentably failed as a Conservative Party to start to address the issues and the reasons why people voted for Brexit in the first place. If we don't do that, we will find ourselves in bad trouble.
Okay, we've got lots of hands up and not much time, so let's start to group questions in threes, right? Sir, make yours succinct. Are there any...
An article last week on Brexit Central said that it's already too late to avoid no deal because there isn't a time for the legislation to go through. If that's true, we should be talking about when rather than if. But can I also say, if fear of no deal is such a big thing, how come 90% of the world trades on WTO basis and also more than half of the UK trade is on a WTO basis with no apparent problems?
If that's actually, well, Dominic Grieve, perhaps you can answer that point. We trade with our biggest partner, America, on WTO terms. We trade with most of the rest of the world in WTO terms. Why should the sky go dark and the plague of locusts come along if we simply change the bureaucratic arrangements from one to another?
Because we are choosing to lose the advantages that Mrs. Thatcher negotiated with such skill for us in the 1980s in creating the single market, which has given us an inestimable economic advantage and generated high levels of trade with our close... High levels of trade with our closest neighbours. We do more trade with Belgium than we do with China. And we are going to endanger that. And we are going to create conditions in which goods are held up, in which certainly if it's a no-deal Brexit, which is what this evening was supposed to be themed round, will in the short to medium term be chaotic, will wreck those industries which are reliant on supply chains, certainly destroy the UK's agricultural base because of the export of things like lamb from Wales to the EU, and do ourselves a great deal of damage. I don't think the EU is a perfect institution at all, but it has been extraordinarily beneficial to our economic growth. And when I look back at what took me into politics, which was the condition this country was in the early 1970s, the transformation brought about by a combination of EU membership and Mrs. Thatcher's leadership has been very considerable. And all that is going to be jeopardised.
Question from the back. Sorry. Yep, ma'am.
You say that's going to be jeopardised, but surely the countries within the EU that trade with us benefit in the way, same way that we do, so surely they will want to get a deal whether or not we get Brexit?
That may well be the case, but we are talking, the theme for this evening was what happens if we leave with no deal? And what will happen with no deal will be extremely unpleasant.
But
I have no idea.
That we will get a deal because countries want one, eventually, pretty soon.
We might get one eventually, but the short and medium-term damage before we get one is going to be very considerable. And in any case, I don't believe, on the basis of everything that we have been talking about in these negotiations, there is a difference between getting a free trade agreement and participating in a single market. And we are not going to have the benefits of participating in a single market. And as that's been particularly important to our service industries, that is going to be a very considerable problem.
James
Forsyth,
can you?
I think it's of a lady's question there. I think it is important to remember, though, that the EU is an institution that is happy to put politics above economics. No institution that put economics ahead of politics would have come up with the single currency. The single currency is a deliberate attempt to put the political cart before the economic horse. The belief was that by creating a currency, you would create the need for political integration. So I think one of the reasons I think lots of people in this country were keen to leave the EU is they thought they had joined an organisation that they believed to be either primarily or purely economic. And it had become apparent over time, something that was actually obvious in the Treaty of Rome, but this was as much about ever closer union as it was about economics. But because of that point, we shouldn't imagine that in the event of no deal, the EU would rush to come to the most economically logical set of solutions to us. I think we need to be open-eyed about that point.
Also, can I just say... What are we actually talking about here? 7% of UK businesses trade with the EU. 93% of our businesses do their trade domestically or with countries outside of the EU. So we are talking, yes, there is a large in terms of revenue and amounts, but we are talking about a minority of operators. And We have huge opportunities which haven't been explored tonight sufficiently, but with our trade and enabling us to pivot to the US, to China, to faster growing economies where we have a trade surplus, where demand for British goods is there, it's growing faster than it is within the EU. They are good customers for us, which make good revenues and good profits and great investment and jobs for businesses in the UK. We should be grabbing those opportunities for the sake of our economy. And it goes without saying, not mentioned tonight, if we do have a WTO no deal Brexit, we do also make a considerable saving of £39 billion. Which works out at £600 million per constituency. Now, I know in Fareham we could do with £600 million in Fareham for a couple of schools and hospitals.
Nikki.
Just a couple of points. I think first we need to be very careful about saying that only 7% of our companies trade with the EU, because it might well be the case that a number of companies trade only domestically, but don't forget they might well be supplying companies and be part of the supply chain, supplying companies that trade with the EU. So anybody who has any experience in manufacturing will know there are lots and lots of very small companies who are part of the supply chain where eventually products end up in cars or aerospace or anything else that ends up being exported and is relying on the single market to do that. You might well be right, sir, about WTO trade, but the point is, if WTO was so fantastic, there will be no free trade agreements. The point is that actually, although what WTO provides a basis, free trade agreements are a far more preferable way to trade in the longer term. And the point of the lady up there, in terms of the, and James is absolutely right, part of the reason why I thought we would eventually get to this situation anyway, I was EU budget minister for a number of months and had to do negotiations, is because we do see life very, very differently in the UK than the EU does. And actually what goes to your question is, it might take a while, but the story of the next couple of decades is going to be a dynamic changing relationship between the UK and the EU in terms of trade, which is why although I want to bring phase one to an end, phase two is undoubtedly going to take longer and will morph into phase three and four and five as our relationship in trade changes with the EU.
Right, let's do some speed dating questions then, fast as we can. Yep, go. Sir, and try and make it quick, and I will try and get another two this time.
This is my actually a question for James. Do you think the British government and the civil service is actually competent enough to do no deal?
I don't think you want to know the answer to that, sir, but I'll ask him anyway. And another two. If you've got the mic, speak into it.
Hello.
Yep.
Question for Suella. How much are you willing to gamble and change the leader, call a general election and change the parliamentary arithmetic to get your no deal?
Very good question. And let's take a third from over here. Yep, King, anyone? Yep, sir. So you've had your arm up. Yep.
My question, is it on?
Yep. We can hear you.
Sorry. My question is to Mr. Grieve. I ask you this as someone who, like you, is part French and who thinks that being, you know, part, the argument that we might be better inside the EU is perfectly valid. But what was the nature of your discussions with the French? And if you did have those discussions, what do you think about, for many of us, the idea of having discussions with a foreign power on these sort of topics, I just find personally quite offensive.
Let's go in reverse order. Dominic Grieve, he was referring to you meeting with Nathalie Loiseau, France's Europe minister. What was all that about?
Well, if I may disappoint you even further, in the course of the last 18 months, I've met with German ministers, Belgian ministers, Swedish ministers, not interestingly enough, before Nathalie Loiseau with a French minister, all to discuss Brexit. And that is a perfectly normal part of my role as a Member of Parliament, just as I'm pretty sure that some of my colleagues in the ERG have done exactly the same thing. As for Nathalie Loiseau's visit, it was exactly what I expected. She came over and asked to meet a range of people in order to get a range of views about what was going on at Westminster. And that is exactly what I gave her, my view as to the take as to what was happening at the moment within Westminster politics, and an explanation of what I and the small number of colleagues who I think we share a view within the Conservative Party about the way Brexit is going, what our opinion was. That is exactly the exchange of opinion that takes place on a regular basis. And as for my being French, I mean, I would just gently point out that my French mother was born in this country, had British nationality from birth, and was a British civil servant.
Okay. James, on the point of competency, cheer us up.
I think it is hard to look at where we are now and to say that the British state has covered itself in glory in terms of its no-deal preparation. I think it's one of those things. No-deal would have been extremely difficult in any circumstance, but I think two things have made it much more difficult. One, I think the UK government waited far too long to start making serious preparations for it. I think it would be in a stronger position in this negotiation if it had prepared from the morning after the referendum for no deal, in terms of, you know, building up alternative routes across the Channel, all that kind of thing. And the second thing which I think makes no deal extremely difficult is the botched general election of 2017. Because I think if you talk to people on the... if you talk to European politicians when they came through London, or on, you know, they worried before that election. They worried about what the UK might do in a no-deal scenario. They thought that a centre-right majority in Parliament might move to slash tax, cut regulation, you know, junk the precautionary principle, move the UK onto a much more dynamic economic footing, and that would present some serious challenges to the EU model. They do not want an alternative economic model on the European continent. But the loss of that majority, and when you look at this Parliament, means that the EU isn't worried about what the government is going to do in the event of no deal, because it's quite clear that in this House of Commons, you couldn't get through a series of radical pro-enterprise reforms. There just aren't the votes for it.
Can I just say, though, as someone who was in a Whitehall department until just a couple of weeks ago, we are better prepared than people say. There's really? Been huge amounts of work done to build new IT systems that are ready to go, to increase capacity, to do catch certificates for the fishing industry, to make sure we've got the teams in place to deal with tariff rate quotas when
so
we
you don't see
tariff.
Queues at Calais or anything like that? Or Dover?
No, so the issue is the difference between... a reasonable best-case scenario where Brexit is a few bumps in the road but things are generally okay, and a reasonable worst-case scenario where it's much harder, really comes down to how the European Union behave and not how we behave.
But how do you think they're going to behave? They're not going to...
The only way you know is to do it and find out. It's the truthful answer to that.
Suella, it was a question to you.
Yes. Being an MP for me, and I'm sure for everyone on this panel, is a privilege and it's not a right. It's not an opportunity for me to disregard the views of the democratically established majority of our society. It's not an opportunity for me to override their wishes. It's not a chance for me to say, I know better than you. It's for me, and it's my duty, to honour with humility the instruction that people give me, and to serve with that in mind. So... You ask me, what am I willing to gamble? I'm not willing to gamble with the trust that people place in me to deliver Brexit and to vote for something that honours the referendum. And with respect, I think you should be directing your question to those who are trying to subvert our democratic arrangement and overturn the result of the referendum.
Okay. Let's take three questions. And, sir, keep it as snappy as you can.
Having visited the killing fields of Fermanagh, it is my impression that the ceasefire in Northern Ireland is very fragile. And by the way, that's why we have 700 MI5 agents in Belfast. Don't you think that no deal would pour petrol on the flames?
Okay, good question. Two more. Yep. And one from... God, you've been hand up all night, sir, so let's hear it.
Thank you. I am a Beaconsfield constituent and a member of Dominic's Association.
Oh, building. Sorry.
Building on Suella's eloquently placed last comments, Dominic, if I can take you back, but I know there's limited time, your clarity and your position regarding the manifesto commitment and your nomination to stand as the MP for Beaconsfield, I don't expect you to answer that, but it's not quite as you say. Therefore, are you trading on the fact of your majority? You've spoken about Tiggers perhaps standing in the Beaconsfield constituency. You have a large majority and has ever been gaining since your election to Parliament in 1997. Therefore, given your position and perhaps the outcome of the constituency AGM on the 29th of March, where we are asked to give a vote of faith in our MP. Given your position previously on Brexit, will you therefore not seek nomination from your association, given your stance on the outcome from the referendum from your association area?
So far as the 29th of March is concerned, I shall wait to see what happens on the 29th of March. I'm privileged and happy to serve at the Beaconsfield constituency as a Conservative Member of Parliament. I'm not quite sure about the bit about the Tiggers. I've no idea if the Tiggers wish to put up candidates in Beaconsfield, but I'm a member of the Conservative Party. That is where I started out my political life, and that is where I very much wish to conclude my political life. I'm a Conservative to my fingertips. And if I may just say on the other question which came up was about the Union and about Northern Ireland. Our Union, which I regard as being really important to our country's future, is under very serious threat. And that is coming about because whilst I accept that the referendum was a nationwide United Kingdom exercise, the hard truth is that if within a United Kingdom that consists of component parts, divergences appear on fundamental issues which are very hard to reconcile, the Union will collapse. It's probably most threatened in Northern Ireland. It's also threatened in our union with Scotland. And as I'm a unionist, that's something which matters to me very much, and which I have to say I think there's been a failure to take properly into account.
I think this issue, and the way Dominic expresses it, has been blown out of proportion, politicised by the EU, and is a red herring, if I'm honest. And of course, there are political, security, economic sensitivities around the border. But we have to remember that the vast majorities of traders who cross this border are small traders. We also need to remember that there are tried and tested administrative and technological solutions, Nikki has been working on this, which already exist within the EU regime that can very, very well accommodate the context around Northern Ireland without having to have a wet stamp and a border inspection post. And so that we can honour the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, which must be done, but we can also enable trade to flow smoothly. And I think, finally, the Northern Ireland Select Committee last week endorsed these views in their Select Committee report, and I invite Dominic and many of you to read it, where it says there is a viable solution to the Northern Irish border issue, and it involves existing techniques and technology.
Well,
Fraser, can I just say...
Yeah, okay.
I was going to say the same, but sir, you're absolutely right. Peace in Northern Ireland, we do not want to go back to the Troubles. We all remember the scenes from the 70s and 80s and further back there and everything else. But there are arrangements that can be put in place. You know, I've been there, I've been in the meetings, we've kicked the tires, absolutely can made to work. And neither side, not the EU, not the Irish government, not the UK government, wants a hard border on the island of Ireland. But can I just say to the gentleman over there, who is going to obviously be sitting potentially in the audience on the 29th of March, we are not the Labour Party. We do not deselect people because of their views. You can fall out with Dominic, you can disagree with him about his views. There might be people here from Suella's constituency, from mine or from George's. But we believe in the Conservative Party, in freedom of speech and freedom of thought. Have your debates with your Member of Parliament, but I think it's wrong to stand there and somehow sort of threaten, imply that somehow people should be standing down from their position as an excellent Member of Parliament for many, many years just because you disagree with them about Brexit.
Well, on that note of harmony, we're going to honour our agreement to let you out of here at 8:30 to your restaurant reservation. So if you look, we're having another event on Thursday to discuss Philip Hammond's budget or what passes for it. So that's at the British Library, so please come along if you want. But now please join me in thanking our panel.